You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with writer and psychologist Matt Fried. Matt Fried, M.A., Ph.D., M.F.A., has been a practicing psychologist for over 35 years. He's in private practice on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, working with individuals, couples, and groups. Many of his clients are writers, performers, and musicians. As a psychologist, he has consulted to a rock band, a basketball team, and to the Obama campaign in Ohio in the fall of 2012. He's taught psychology on the high school and college levels. Days of Hope, a CD of his original songs, was released in 2007. He has led writer's block groups at the Vermont College of Fine Arts and will be leading similar sessions, including a psychology for writers group at the upcoming St. Augustine Writers Conference in Florida, which is stAugustineWritersConference.com. He received his MFA in fiction from the Vermont College of Fine Arts in 2012. His work has appeared in Pulp House, You Are Here, New York City Streets in Poetry, and Paragraphs. He's also published professional articles in Psychiatry, a journal of interpersonal processes, and the Journal of School Psychology. When I spoke with Matt Fried, I began by asking him to talk in a bit more detail about his writing and psychology backgrounds and his practice.
I've been practicing for over 30 years in New York City. So I'm a psychologist, and I see individuals, couples, and I do some groups. And I also supervise some therapists. So that's what I do professionally. And I'm in training. I constantly train with, you know, different things that are happening in the field so I can keep myself, my skill level more current. Because the field is growing very quickly, and new things are being, people are working in new ways, and the brain stuff is really happening, and information about how the brain works is really happening. So I'm trying to stay abreast of that work, and so that's part of what I do too, to try to, and I try to keep that all into 3 days a week. Uh-huh. And try to write the rest of the time.
And you write both fiction and poetry, right?
I do. I started out writing poetry as a younger person and studied with a poet named Colette Inez, who lives on the Upper West Side. And then I went to a science fiction writer's workshop because that's what I thought I wanted to do, was write some science fiction because I loved reading it. And so out of that, I started writing science fiction stories and published one of them, and then I sort of let it lapse. I think I got blocked since, or yeah, was too scared to really commit to writing, and I went back to being a therapist full-time, which I had always been, but somehow I had thought maybe I'll write, but I wasn't ready to commit to it for many reasons, and so I went back to my practice, and that's what I've been doing until I realized at some point about 4 years ago that I really wanted to write, and if I didn't do it now, I wasn't going to get to do it. So that's when I applied to VCFA.
Which is Vermont College of Fine Arts.
Right.
I'm curious, when you got blocked and went back to your practice more full on and sort of stopped writing for a while, how soon after that publication of the science fiction story was that? Did you feel like that was associated with that at all?
No.
No. Okay.
I did not. I don't know. It took about 2 years for that story to get published, and I did get paid rather well for it, about $500.
Wow.
So, it wasn't that. It was just like I got married, I had a baby, and so I was engaged in that kind of thing, and somehow the writing dropped away.
Oh, okay, sure.
Okay. So, and I didn't have a support group. I was still trying to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did was I suddenly had a resurgence as a musician. People started hiring me to do certain things, and I spent a number of years playing music and doing therapy.
Okay. What's your instrument?
Guitar.
Do you write songs?
I write songs. I put out a CD of my own music. Then, and it's on iTunes.
Great.
So it's called Days of Hope, and I put a lot of time into that creative endeavor.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I was getting paid. I started to learn Jewish music,
uh-huh.
and at one point I was working for four synagogues. I learned the liturgy, and I was very engaged in that kind of work. So the writing, again, was going into writing music and doing that kind of stuff.
So klezmer, yeah. or other sorts of...
Religious kind of, dance music, but religious dance music.
Okay, all right.
With hundreds and hundreds of people dancing to kind of religion. It's very great music.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of it's beautiful. So I got into it and spent a good time there till I soured on it.
Okay. So when you went through your own writer's block, is that what got you thinking about all these ideas?
Yeah, because I'm a believer in psychotherapy. I do it, and I'm a patient in psychotherapy. I have been for a long time,
uh-huh.
and I use it to keep my head clear and work out issues that are constantly coming up, as they do in life. And so one thing that came up was about feeling blocked and very anxious when I wanted to. As soon as I entered the program, my first packet, tremendous amount of anxiety. And I think I was working with Ellen Lesser,
mm-hmm.
at the time, and she was helpful. And then I got to work with Dave Jouse. And I experienced this all along, and so I kept working at what was going to help me through my anxiety, which would lead me to avoid even sitting down for a while.
Okay.
So that was one block. It was a block, but when people use the idea of block, it really is referring to so many different possible ways. Okay.
Yes.
So avoidance is the end result of something else that's happening. So I was very anxious. So I didn't want to have that anxiety. So I'd avoid sitting down and writing.
Okay.
Once I could sit down and write, I, would go a certain amount, and then I would get inordinately tired. That was another block, so I'd want to go to sleep.
That is what happens to me. I will want to go to sleep.
It's extremely compelling experience. You could almost fall off your chair into a deep sleep, right?
Right.
Rip Van Winkle kind of sleep. It feels that deep. So that's another way of shutting down.
That's what happens when I don't know what's supposed to happen next in my fiction. I don't know what's supposed to happen next, and I'm very tired, so I think I'll just go take a nap instead of writing.
Here in your language, I don't know what's supposed to happen, as if there's a supposed to.
Right.
Actually, it's like now you're on the edge of the unknown.
Yeah.
And something might come up and emerge rather than be supposed to.
Yeah.
And that emergent moment is scary. Because you're really opening yourself up to an unknown thing that might emerge in your consciousness. And I think, in my understanding of it, is that people's minds are trying to protect themselves from this kind of unknown thing that they don't know what's going to pop up.
Right.
So this kind of protection, you end up shutting down, okay, in various ways. Like, go to sleep, or if you avoid, you don't have to even have to deal with that shutting down.
Right.
And other people have used alcohol, for example, or drugs to get through that moment of panic or fear. But what I'm saying is I think those are protective devices. The shutting down is protection. You're protecting yourself from something that could be upsetting to yourself.
Right.
Okay?
Yes.
And the way I'm approaching it now is that one has to honor that need for protection in order to really help you resolve the block.
Okay.
You can't just barrel through it or drug your way through it. And then, of course, if you drug yourself through it or alcohol, you then create a secondary problem.
Right.
You now have to deal with your alcohol problem. Okay. That's enough of an avoidance, right?
Now, there were a lot of things in the papers that you sent me, in the information that you sent me about your study of writer's block that I found so interesting. And just one small thing was an analogy that I loved, which was that writer's block protects us the same way pain protects our joints. When you have a muscle that's not really protecting the joint adequately, there will be pain in order to kind of let your body know to kind of leave that part of your body alone.
Right. Don't use that part.
Don't use that part. Right. And in a way, the writer's block is our way of not using our brain because we're going to a scary place. Is that how you would put it?
We're going to a place that the self is not does not know about and could be dysregulating, overwhelming, or bring up material that is, could be overwhelming.
Right.
Associated to someone's history that you've tried to keep away or something like that for yourself.
Okay.
All that stuff. So, because people are constantly trying to grow and move forward, but they're also trying to protect themselves and stay whole,
yeah,
not fragment and not go in. So there's, you're trying to kind of regulate yourself, and then what you're doing here is possibly dysregulating yourself. We're in the writing mode of opening ourselves up to those inner places and tapping it as the source of the writing, even though it's being filtered through our consciousness and our cognitive abilities and our logical minds. It's still the spring, the wellspring is deeper inside. And if you open to that, it could lead you to places you don't want to go.
Right, right. I also found it so interesting because I've heard people talk a little bit before about fear of success or fear of failure, fear of tapping in, like you're saying, into something that you're not really sure you want to emotionally confront. But another part of your studies, which I found so interesting, was that when we're in a creative state, we are less likely to be vigilant about protecting ourselves, you know, the part of ourselves that wants to be watching for predators and, you know, the part of ourselves that was formed millions of years ago. That right. was very interesting to me.
Right. We're not on alert.
On alert.
We're in an altered state of consciousness.
Yeah.
So like, you know, even like if you think of an astronaut, if you take astronauts up in space, you don't really want an astronaut that's going to go, oh my God, this is like amazing. You want somebody looking at the dial, oxygen, right? They can't be going into an altered state there. So in a way, I'm just saying of necessity, we must go into that state because that's the nature of the writing process.
Right.
Tap that. So we are then out of alertness to the outside world.
Right.
John Gardner talked about that. You know, you go into your writing trance, but that's the very place that, you know, this stuff could happen and come up. So you're not only out of touch with the outside world, you're then opening yourself up to all this possible inside stuff as well. So naturally, the protective parts of you are going to be saying, whoa. They need to be reassured that this can happen in a good way, in a way.
Well, yeah, yeah.
You have to do that, yeah.
Now, I wonder if you could just spend really just a very brief minute to talk about what the left and the right sides of the brain do.
The left brain is more cognitive, logical, reality kinds of processes.
Okay.
And the right brain is more, you know, creative processes, but body sensation, emotion, mm-hmm. going through. I'm being extremely general, but those are the differences. And you need both to function, okay? And you need both to write, because you're not just lopping off one side.
Mm-hmm.
I would just say about the, you know, people who are fear of success and things like that.
Yeah.
Those are like, that's a very big abstraction to say that, unless one actually has the immediate experience of being fearful of it. It's more interpretive. You know, like when you say to somebody who has a difficulty in relationships, like you're trying to find people who are going to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that happens. I think people are trying to find people that won't hurt them. But they may end up with somebody that doesn't. They don't know how to get out of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Or they're not trying. So you're not trying to avoid success necessarily. You have to take it down to, like, what's happening in the moment when you're sitting there. Can you tap into what's going on inside of you? And I know for me personally, there was one fear was that I would go insane. That if I tapped into that part of me, there was going to be some insanity that would happen. Okay. So that was, and I directly felt that, that I would go crazy. And then the more I tapped into it and worked at it in therapy, I realized I wasn't about to go crazy at all. And so I reassured myself that I could get into that place and I wouldn't go crazy.
Okay. But
that was a fear.
And then another, another version of maybe that same sort of fear is that if you deal with some of the emotional problems that are blocking you, that then you won't have any material left. Not you, but one, you know, writers. And I thought that was really interesting, that people are concerned they're going to run out of material if they fix all of their problems.
Or they, yeah. So this is something I've encountered as a therapist a lot, okay, with artists, that they're afraid that, that their material's coming from how screwed up they are and how disturbed they are, and they don't want to go in and get undisturbed because they won't have any more energy and material. And that's, to me, is a completely false notion, okay? Because the way people work is when you have these disturbances, your body, yourself is trying to protect yourself from the disturbances.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of your psychic energy is tied up in trying to contain all this stuff, and you can't do other things. You can't create so well. So if you actually resolve some of these things, you don't forget the experiences. They don't go away. You still have them to draw on, but you're freer now to draw on them. So to me, that's a false notion, that if you resolve this stuff, it's no longer useful as in your creative self. It's actually more available. Okay.
Okay.
You're less frightened of it, and you don't have to do as many things to defend yourself against it.
Right.
So you really have it to draw on, and you have more perspective. You have a lot of different angles to it. So all the artists that I've spoken with seem to produce more the more they resolve.
Now, would you say, however, that you've noticed through your work that people who, I'm going to use a not scientific term, but people who might see themselves as more damaged are the ones who are more drawn to an artistic life? Or is that a complete generalization?
Generalization. I do.
It's a generalization.
Yeah.
Okay.
People who are very damaged, you know, to do an artistic life takes a lot, not just the artistic part.
Right.
But one needs a community, one needs relationships, one needs skill, one needs, you know, to have enough money to create, to have space to write in or to paint in or to make music in, you know. That takes a lot of ego and a lot of skills.
Right.
It's not just, you know, you can't be that disturbed and function in that environment and do that, because you're not, you know. When you read, like, the beginning of a novel, and the preface says, I want to thank the next 40 people.
Yeah.
Okay? You know this person had a community going around his novel and his writing. People were reading, supporting him. You know, God knows what. You're disturbed and you can't have relationships. You're not going to have that.
Right. You talked in your work that you shared with me, you talked about writer's block sometimes coming after a rejection. And I think you were talking about, you know, feeling rejected because your work's been criticized. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about professional rejection. So trying to get our work out into the world, sending it out to agents, or if we already have an agent, sending it out to publishing houses, and the ability to keep going in the face of what sometimes feels like a lot of rejection.
Well, it is a lot of rejection.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Sometimes it feels like it. Sometimes it is. Literal rejection. So you need resilience to persevere in that. But since... But the notion of rejection is tied to, let's say you are producing some piece of work that you are giving birth to.
Yes.
And you are investing yourself in there, Dave Joust says and many other people, you can't help but write about yourself in whatever you're doing. It's still pieces of yourself are embedded, even if they're disguised, in what you're writing. So now you give birth to something new that's yours, and you put it out into the world, and somebody doesn't want it. Okay? Okay. It's an injury. It's an injury. There's no way around it. It could be wounding. Okay?
Yeah.
So, but one needs to be able to persevere in the face of those wounds and to find a way to not let it stop you. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, but it can bring up, if you have been rejected a lot earlier in your life, you may get thrown there. And some people I've spoken to have just dropped away for years because of a rejection. They just gave up or got too scared because the pain of that rejection brought up other pain of earlier rejections, and it was just too much for them to bear alone. And so they would go away from that until they could gather enough strength to try it again and find some ways to have a perspective on that. And one way is, like, for example, you see it as a numbers game.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to send out to 100 different places, and the chances are that you might get one acceptance, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that might be at number 3 or number 99, and you don't know when. So it's really, you're just doing numbers.
Right.
And you're not involved with who it is. But that's the perspective where you're not getting caught up. You know the system, and you know the world, and you know how much, you know, how many people are submitting at one time.
Right.
And so it's not a personal thing anymore. And other times you have a support group that keeps working. You know, you go to them and say, I feel bad. You talk through your feelings, and then you go to the next time.
Yeah.
But it could stop certain people who are more isolated, for example, and don't have community. They get rejected, and it's so traumatic or brings up earlier trauma that they just pull back in protection again. They can't go through that pain.
Now, one way that I know some people deal with writer's block is to be very routine-oriented and to write every single day. And you hear this a lot, that you have to write every single day.
Yeah.
Now, personally, I sometimes find that a little intimidating, because if I miss a day, then maybe I'll go into a big sort of spiral of, oh, I missed a day and I fell out of my routine and suddenly it all falls apart. Does that sound familiar? Do people say that happens to them?
Well, they develop a compulsivity, which is to do it every day. So it's a compulsive thing. But it also reassures the self that, look, you're doing it every day and you haven't gone crazy. You haven't fallen apart. You know, nothing is coming up that's upsetting. You can handle it. So it's a demonstration. So the self might feel like we need to do this every day in order to keep ourselves, you know, reassured that this is a good process to do. So that's one thing that could happen. Again, it's protective. But I think, you know, with all compulsions, if you don't do it one day, you could start to have anxiety.
Yeah.
So you need to sort of get out of the compulsion state. But I was going to say, like, when I did the group at the Vermont College of Fine Arts, one woman came in and said, well, I'm blocked. And what was the block? She was afraid to mail her submissions. She had this, she had written it out. She had the envelope, and she could not put it in the mailbox. And so that was her thing. I keep avoiding sending them out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I took something that represented that envelope and I put it in front of her. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's make believe this is that submission. What happens when I put the envelope directly in front of you? And she grabbed her chest. She said, oh my God, I'm terrified.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so she then realized it wasn't that she was avoiding mailing it so much as she was terrified of mailing it. She really got it that she was scared. So she couldn't figure out why am I not mailing this? Okay, she was like away from that experience. So now she knew that she was terrified. Okay, so we didn't go into why, but you could figure if you're scared, if something's frightening about mailing it, why mail it? Okay, it's protective again. Why are you going to frighten yourself? You follow?
Yeah.
So I just was playing around. I said, well, here's this woman sitting next to you. Let's say we move the envelope over to her, and she said, I'll mail it for you. okay, how do you feel then? And she said, fantastic. Okay. Okay. That was a woman with a lot of friends, and it had not occurred to her that she could simply give the envelope to her buddy and have her drop in the mailbox for her. Okay.
Yeah.
We didn't go into anything. Why? All right. The fact that it hadn't occurred to her was interesting, but she felt relieved, like, oh, I got it. Okay, fine. I'm just going to call up, you know, Betsy and give her the envelopes.
That's so interesting because it disarms the whole problem, doesn't it? I'm trying to think of what word I'm looking for. You know, in a way, it identifies the problem as not very logical, or your reaction as not very logical, and you come up with a logical solution that disarms the problem.
Or, yeah, a logical and an obvious, easy solution, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And there was another woman who said, well, I can't write anything because if I write anything, my mother's going to find out.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
I had a mother who was so invasive and intrusive and, you know, such a, you know, prison guard in a sense that, and she had in her mind that her mother's reach was like all over, right?
Yeah.
So somebody said, well, it just spoke up and said, well, what if you wrote it and gave it to me, okay,
yeah,
and I'll put it in a safe deposit box until you're ready to mail it or send it in, okay?
Yeah.
She said, I could do that. So in other words, she wasn't going to write anything. She was shutting down her even just the creative part because once it was out on any paper or on the screen, she felt her mother would get to it somehow, and then she'd be right out of the family. So she's protecting herself from being expelled from the family because of her mother.
Yeah. Okay.
And she doesn't want to lose her mother. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
So somebody said, well, but now you can't even write it out. You can't even get it out, even the first draft, because you're afraid your mother hasn't reached. But give me your first draft and I'll protect it for you. And believe me, nobody will get past me. She said, oh, I could do that. So then she got opened up and able to write whatever she wanted, knowing it was going to go to a safe place. And then later on down the road, she'll have to deal with whether she, what needs to be done to make it safe to put it into the world.
Right, right.
Okay. At least we got the first step.
And that's a kind of, you know, there are also people who have to give themselves permission to say, I can delete this when it's done, or I can, you know, I can write whatever I want now, and then I can erase it so that nobody ever sees it, but at least I get it written.
That is so important that you're saying that, because lots of people think that, you know, once they write it out, they've got to put it into the world as if they don't have any ability to regulate what they do with it. So they can't even write it because it's going to flow naturally to somebody will read it, and either they'll be rejected or somebody will criticize it or something. So just to give them the free space, safe space to write it and say, you have the right to even not let anybody look at it.
Yeah.
Okay?
I would think that the era that we're in now with all of this technology would be making some of these problems a little more complicated because so much writing is done in a public forum. And people will need to be reassured that, in fact, they can just take out a notebook and write it down. They don't have to put it on Facebook right away. You know?
Right. Right. Well, unless somebody's hacking their computer, they are pretty safe. But if they put it in the cloud, yeah. Okay. And if they put it on Facebook, most definitely.
Yeah.
But if they just have a file in their computer, it's fairly safe. Nobody, unless your mother is like a professional hacker. Now, I'm not saying there aren't those parents around.
I wonder, Matt, I was going to ask you if you could talk a little bit about the opposite of writer's block. What happens when we are having a lot of success and we're in the moment and it's flowing? What would you say about that?
Keep doing it and just, you know, that's what I did when I did this paper. I asked people to tell me when they were blocked.
Yes.
When they weren't blocked and what that experience was like. What's the experience of being blocked and what's the experience of not being blocked?
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of people shared what it was like. Flow, a sense of being very centered with themselves, a sense of euphoria, a sense of everything and trust, self-trust of the self, that things are flowing, and it's kind of surprising. There's new things happening that they didn't expect, and it just has and you're totally in that zone, okay?
Right.
That's happening. And then sometimes you slide out of that back into your working more consciously, and there's a sense of effort to it. And other times that you go back into it and there's a sense of non-effort, but you're still not blocked. But when you're really in it, it's a lovely feeling. It may be tinged with a little anxiety around the edges because it's so, you're getting into unknown things. Things are emerging, but you feel the flow of yourself and you feel a kind of ability to tap into yourself, and you may not be so consciously writing. It's coming out and you're discovering more than you're, thinking of it in advance. It's sort of occurring. Oh my God, I'm watching the character do this. You have an inner visual scene, and it's happening, and you're just watching it occur, and you're writing it down.
Right, and it's funny, in reading your work, your research, it occurred to me that when that happens, it's almost like another protective mechanism. You're not responsible because you're just receiving it.
Yeah, but it is. But at the same time, your self-tracking, is this upsetting to you? So there is still a tracking function. Can you handle this material?
Right.
But at the same time, think of a dream. You know, the dream is trying to keep you asleep.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's, fashioning stories to do that and things like that. But if it gets really upsetting, it might wake you up.
Right.
Okay. But it's certainly generating things that are completely new that you've never, maybe weaving in things, but it's certainly not a replay of your reality. It's more of a refashioning of things. And so it's tending to give you the story, but it's not tending to wake you up.
Yes.
Unless it does, it's a nightmare. Then you're waking up. Then you're saying, I can't deal with this material. My conscious mind, okay?
Yeah.
I think the self is trying to protect itself naturally to stay in one whole place, mm-hmm. to tap into new things and move forward and try to emerge more of yourself, but always checking to see that you can handle it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the process. And so as you do it more and more, you feel safer that you can go into this world.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Well, so... we talked about flow, but now moving back into writer's block, you had a number of strategies that you discussed. You don't necessarily recommend all of them, but you discussed these different strategies. Like the one that you seem not to recommend very much is going to war with the self, or totally, sort of like trying to push through. Or I don't know. What do you think? Yeah. Is that?
Yeah. People sometimes use that to going to war with the self. Like, I don't like this. I don't like what I'm doing, and I'm going to change it, goddammit, and I'm going to, fight this part of myself, and that's what I mean by going to war.
Right.
Like you have a symptom and, something. So the writer's block is like a symptom.
Yeah.
Maybe it's occurring at the avoidance stage. Maybe it's occurring where it shuts you down after being open. Maybe it shuts you down after you've been rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Different ways it can approach. But you're saying, I'm not going to let this, I'm going to do a stiff upper lip, we suck it up, and I'm just going to fight. Now, you could do that, but what I'm saying is you're then fighting yourself.
Yeah.
Okay? And so then you're going to be split internally. One party is trying to protect you, and you're saying, no. I don't want you to protect me. I'm going to override you. So that usually makes the protective parts fight harder. We're saying, this conscious dude, he's not listening to us. We gotta work harder. And when I do therapy with people around, not writer's block necessarily, but symptoms like that, and I say, well, let's have the you that's that your normal you sit in this chair, but we're gonna put in the other chair this part of you that's protecting yourself. Now, if you sit in the other chair, I'm gonna interview you like you're that other part.
Okay.
You see what comes up. And when we talk to that part, it says, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. I got to work the overtime to keep him. I don't care if I shut him down. I don't care if I make him, isolated from people. I'll do whatever I can to keep him safe. And he doesn't have to like it. Okay. So then you have that kind of split. So then you have to ask, well, what could he do? So even having the person listen to that side of himself starts to have a little bit of a change and have more compassion for himself. Like, not trying to hurt himself. This is not an attempt to stop him from being a writer. This is just an attempt to protect him. And if he can just ask, what do I need to do to help my protective part? Maybe their protective parts are using kind of more childlike methods. You know, they're younger parts usually, and they're using methods that one would use at a younger age, and you don't need those anymore. You can figure out something more. Mm-hmm. So what you're trying to do is just make the protective thing get better at it in a way that's more effective and less obstructive.
Yeah.
Okay, because the obstruction is not intended. It's just a byproduct of that.
Of the protection.
Of the protection, yeah. It's an intended byproduct.
Okay.
So you're seeing it that way. So the symptoms are not there to hurt you, even though they may be having hurtful consequences. But you have to get to, well, how can I protect myself better?
Yeah.
And I'm going to give you, you know, just one example. Like, if you are raised in a family where you don't get a lot of physical love and attention, okay,
mm-hmm.
and you grow up having to cope with that, so one thing you can do is say, well, I'm never going to get any attention. The only way I'm going to give myself attention is to attend to myself and my own needs. You really can't trust other people. They're not going to come through for you.
Right.
So you got to take care of yourself. So you grow up and you adopt that sense of, well, I got to take care of myself here, and nobody else will do it. Now you get married, and you're still running that protective model. You're living it. It doesn't work in a marriage because your partner wants to be with you and help you.
Right.
And you're going to keep pushing that away and saying, I don't trust it. I don't trust it. So that is a dysfunctional solution. It worked then. It maybe really helped you survive your childhood. So on a design level, it worked really well. But now it's dysfunctional on a design level.
Right.
So you have to help the person realize you got to redesign it to do what it needs to do, but now you're older and you can do more different ways of doing it that are less, you know, make your life less difficult.
Yeah, yeah. When you sit down with people to talk about these sorts of issues and you know, writer's block or what you're talking about, relationship stuff, like, it must be so extraordinary when they start to break through some of this stuff.
It is.
And so how can artists approach a therapist? Like, how do you suggest people find somebody if they want to talk to, if they want to go through psychotherapy to address some of their creative issues? First of all, how do they find somebody who's a good person to talk to? How do they do that research? And also, what do you bring to this situation and explain what's going on?
Well, here's the thing that is my working model.
Okay.
Whatever you're doing in terms of problems that you have in your life, if they're like patterns of problems, you know, where you don't trust people, or let's say you can't write or something like that, you're avoiding writing or you get scared, you're going to do it everywhere you go. So when you get in, so because people are consistent, they do their patterns everywhere. They don't just do it in one place usually. It's usually consistent over in different contexts.
Yeah.
Although there may be a few that they don't, but let's say typically what happens is, so if somebody comes into therapy, they're going to be doing their pattern in therapy themselves.
Mm.
They're going to be coming to change it, but they're going to be doing it in the moment as we're sitting there. If they don't trust, they're not going to trust me.
Right,
okay.
Sure.
Okay. So we have then the opportunity to work on that right there. Okay, and that's where therapy is going to happen, in that relationship, in that moment. You can tap it because it's not outside. It didn't happen the other day. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
And so you can then try to work through, what do I need to do for you to trust me? What do you need to do to trust me? And that will then expand backwards in history and change things. But you have to have somebody who's willing to work in the moment,
mm-hmm.
and not just talk about stuff from the past, or whatever, or not just talk about the block outside. So with writing, you would bring in your writing stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
Right there with the therapist. Try writing right there. It's going to happen.
So just sit down and write with this other person in the room.
Yeah, and they're going to wait and be there. And if you don't trust them, let's say, oh, I can't do it with you, or then you have right there, why is that happening? You can work on that piece, right?
Yeah.
There's something happening. Or I'm writing and it starts to get blocked. So you have at that moment a kind of now interpersonal bubble where you're actually taking the thing and you're doing it and you're experiencing the problem in the moment, and the therapist is willing to be there and saying, what's going on inside of you at this moment that you're having this thing?
And so do people ever say, I can't write with somebody else watching me?
You would say, okay, would you like me to turn around?
Okay.
Okay, then they become somebody who's willing to adapt to their needs. Maybe they've never had somebody. Why can't they write with somebody watching them?
Right.
Okay, nobody's staring at them. They're just sitting there, right?
Yeah, sure.
So I say, when some of that happens, if you think of homework as a model, most kids, they're under tremendous pressure in school and they're given homework. Do they do it with people? No, they only do it with people if they're having problems. But usually they're sent to their desk and they sit there, and if they're feeling anxious or overwhelmed, too bad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's the model of doing work. Nobody's there.
Yeah.
So I say, if you bring your work, and I've done this with my therapist, I would bring in writing, and I'd spend 15 minutes trying to write something and to be exploring what's going on with me as I'm trying to do this in the moment, how am I feeling with him there, and we'd work on that, and it would open it all up.
Huh.
Okay. We wouldn't have to go outside. We wouldn't have to remember things. That bubble would contain all the information, and then we could travel to the past and work on feelings, but it would be happening right. So you need a therapist who's willing to work with you about what's happening in the moment.
Sure.
In that session.
Right. So, and getting through the trust part first makes it probably easier to sit down and write with that person in the room.
Yeah, but think of this. Working through the trust part is like enormous.
Yeah.
If you work through the trust part, you've worked through a huge piece of your life. Like, okay? Just that is going to open you up tremendously.
Right.
To work through a trust part.
Right.
And you may start out mistrusting, and that's okay, because say this is an opportunity to work on that right here.
Yeah.
So you need therapists who are unafraid to be present.
For it. Okay.
So that's what you're looking for, somebody who can be present.
All right. Now, you talk about a couple other strategies that I thought were really interesting. You talk about going away strategies, basically leaving your writing behind and doing something else. And then another one that I was really interested in, and I'm trying to remember what you called it, strategies of alignment. And those strategies really sort of reminded me of Natalie Goldberg's exercises, you know, the writing down the bones type of exercises where you let go of your outcomes and expectations, you give yourself permission to delete, like we already talked about.
Right.
You do a lot of free writing. She has one where you don't pay any attention to margins on the page. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about those, the going away strategies and then the alignment strategies.
Well, the going away is to get you to help you out of the part of you that's making it hard for you to write. And so you leave it. So then you're saying, okay, I'll respect this protective part of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have another experience. You know, usually let's say you take a walk in the woods, you go running, you do exercise, you garden, whatever. You know, you're in your physical self.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're then having all these kinds of emotional, physiological, sensational experiences. And you're not in the part of your brain that's doing this creativity. So you've actually distracted yourself and you're in another state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. An altered state, your own state. So when you go back, it might clear up at that point. There might be an absence of the protective part may need to be less active at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what some people use, and they find that helps. Like, you know, if they start writing, the protective part comes right in automatically, no matter how many years they've worked. Be careful, don't, you know. Go away, you do some deep breathing and get into your body. And it may just, the voice may be one of those old archaic tape recordings that people have in their minds, and it may just die down.
Yeah.
Like some people, if they have these kinds of critical voices and things like that, I just go on and on and on. You'll never get that right, da-da-da. You know, why are you doing this? Don't you know you can't? Even if you've had books published, people have these, right?
Yeah.
So you just tell somebody, you know, I tell my patients, just do sit-ups. You know, do 10 sit-ups. by the time you're finished, that voice won't be there. because consciousness is only so big.
Yeah.
Only holds so many chunks of information at any one time. And if you fill up your consciousness with body experience, there's no room for that voice anymore. So you're just getting rid of it for the moment. And then when you go back, you'll see if it's still there. Usually it's diminished.
I remember once reading that there's actually a reason that we often will have ideas when we are not able to write them down. So like in the shower or driving the car or something like that, that in fact our brain works that way, so that there's a part of the brain freed up when you're doing these other activities. Is that anything that rings a bell for you?
Well, it fits in with the sense of safety. Like when you're in the shower, you could have this idea, you're not going to put it down, right? Oh, now's a safe time to give you that idea.
Right.
You can handle it here in the shower, and maybe you'll forget it by the time you get out.
Well, I guess I'm thinking that that's another going away activity, because if you go away to do something away from your desk, maybe you'll have a good idea.
But sometimes you want to just follow it. Like if you, Milton Erickson, who was a famous psychiatrist, used to say, you know, let's say you have the horse, you want him to drink from the pond, but he's facing away from the pond. Okay, how do you get him to drink? Do you yank him around, which is like going to war?
Right.
So he said, no, you walk him in the direction he's already facing, away from the lake, in a big circle.
Okay.
So you're going to respect the need to go away, and you're going to try to get it back gradually and see what happens.
Circle back,
yeah, but you're still going in the direction the horse is already going in.
I like that. That's great. That's a good one.
Well, again, going away is one way of just changing your outlook and remembering that you're you, you're okay, your body is working, things are fine. It's a reminder to the self that things in your life are okay.
Yeah. One last part that, and actually we haven't covered all of your material, but we have a little bit of time left, and I wanted to make sure we didn't neglect to talk about community and relationship strategies, that using your community as a strategy to overcoming writer's block. And some of that might be working with a therapist, but some of that might be being in a writer's group or a friend. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that everybody... And people need to feel located, like they have to be located in the consciousness of other people. So you want to exist in the consciousness of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, it's a terrifying thing. You don't have roots. We want to be, we know that we exist inside of other people in their minds. We have a place inside the other. And sometimes, you know, that happens that people don't have that experience, and they have to work very hard to feel that they belong anyway. The same thing with our writing. It's very good if we have a community where we know other people are aware of what we are trying to do in our writing. If somebody else in their consciousness knows, hey, how are you doing with that bit of writing? How are you doing with that character? That's a community. The community is our awareness that we exist and our struggle exists in the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
So the more you can generate other people who are caring about your work and your struggle, that's community in a sense. So whether you're with a therapist, a counselor, you have a writing group, the people are tracking you and you're tracking others, that's community. With friends, it's anybody that you can have. Some friends might read your work, but at least they're aware you're doing it.
Yeah.
So that's community, you know, loved ones, etc. So the more we're on other people's radar, the more located we feel, and I think that's supportive for our work. We're not writing in the void, in the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you see those 40 names on the beginning of novels. I want to thank, and it goes on for pages.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
People have had little points of insertion and involvement and engagement in that writer's work at certain points, you know, different parts of it. Maybe they made egg for him or her, you know. But they had each had a part, so that's community.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's funny, one thing I found so interesting, I was interviewing an author once, a very successful author, an author who had won the National Book Award, okay?
Yeah.
And he talked about how painful it is when he's at a reading and someone comes up and says, they didn't like his book, or they didn't like his work, or they didn't, you know, they didn't like this character. And it really struck me, just like, we never overcome some of this stuff. It's always going to be there. So I don't know. What is your reaction to that? Do we just have to sort of accept that these issues of confidence will always be part of who we are?
Well, it's not confidence.
Okay.
The example you gave, his confidence didn't fall in his own writing. He simply had a twinge of, he got wounded for a second.
Okay.
There. He had a feeling of painfulness because he had given birth to this character and this book, and somebody said, I don't like it. So that hurt. So, okay, that's all it was. It wasn't his confidence.
Right.
Okay. It just hurt. So if you have a baby and somebody doesn't like your baby, you're going to feel hurt. That's
right.
What it is. So we have to learn how to tolerate those feelings, okay? To tolerate the feelings that are going to be there and allow them to – the feelings come in waves. You know, they peak and then they drop. So that's all they are. So the more we can allow them to be there, the easier it will be. That's life.
Yeah.
It's just like guilt. You know, when people – if you have any morality at all, you're going to feel guilt in life because – life is not black and white. So let's say you do something and you know somebody's going to be disappointed, but you need to do it for yourself. Let's say, okay?
Uh-huh.
Instead of saying, I have a right to do this thing, just say, okay, yeah, he's not going to like that. And I feel bad about that. And that badness is a feeling in my body. It'll wave, it'll peak and go. So instead of having to do inner gyrations about it, you just say, I'll tolerate my guilt. Okay? The feeling. So it's, again, feelings peak and then they go away. You just got to ride them out.
Okay. Great. Well, this has been very helpful. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And Matt Fried, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Matt Fried. Just a reminder, he will be leading Writer's Block sessions at the upcoming St. Augustine Writers Conference, October 3rd through 8th. 2013 in St. Augustine, Florida. And he's doing other things there too. And there are other things going on being led by other people. So that website is staugustinewritersconference.com. staugustinewritersconference.com. I'm going to link this site to the podcast to today's show. So if you don't have a pencil on you, you can look at the podcast later and find that website. Write the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic gigabit network. And VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Phoenix Books Burlington presents Peggy Shin, author of Deluge, Tropical Storm Irene, Vermont's Flash Floods, and How One Small State Saved Itself, Wednesday, August 28th at 7. The Battery Park Poetry Slam, Young Writers Project's outdoor word fest of original verse, takes place Thursday, August 29th at 7:30. Poet Jeff Hewitt will participate. More information at youngwritersproject.org. Rhoda Gallery in Plattsburgh presents an open mic poetry night Thursday, August 29th at 8. Poet Michael Carino shares selected verse, after which readers, writers, and singers perform in a supportive environment. More information at rotagallery.com, R-O-T-A. Burr Morse, author, sugarmaker, and seventh-generation Vermonter, reads from selected works and discusses changes in the sugaring industry during his lifetime. Saturday, August 31st at 7 at Little River State Park in Waterbury. Poet, editor, and book designer Anne Aspel joins award-winning poet Major Jackson in an evening of literature as part of the Big Town Project's Summer Reading Series, Saturday, August 31st at 5:30 at Big Town Gallery in Rochester, Vermont. More information at bigtowngallery.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Matt Fried, and it's a great one for dealing with writer's block. Write about a way in which you usually protect yourself in your daily life. You can define protection any way you like, emotionally, communication-wise, physically, whatever. Then write about the reason or reasons you believe you protect yourself in this way. Ask yourself, do I still need to do this? Finally, write about what might be a better, more effective, possibly less emotionally costly way to accomplish self-protection. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing the outcome of a writing prompt from the show, please email me at writethebook@gmail.com. If you'd like to share the show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And in case you didn't know this, I always write out each week's writing prompts, on the podcast site. So if you don't have a chance to write down a writing prompt that I announce, you can go to the podcast site to see the prompt. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, news about book-related events, or a writing prompt to share, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And then finally, do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.